Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Stephen Young, senior analyst with the Union of Concerned Scientists, who takes a critical look at the Bush administration's decision to deploy an anti-ballistic missile system in Alaska by 2004. Joanne Landy, co-director of the Campaign for Peace and Democracy, who assesses the ability of the U.S. peace movement to slow down or stop the White House drive for war with Iraq. And Francois Girard of the International Women's Health Coalition, who discusses the Bush administration's assault on women's reproductive rights and what groups and individuals can do to fight back. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
All the dossiers on the war crimes of Saddam Hussein's Iraq floating around Washington, D.C. and London fail to account for one of the worst abuses against Iraqi Kurds during the outbreak of the Iran-Iraq War in 1980. According to Robert Fisk, the longtime Middle East correspondent for the British Independent newspaper, 5,000 young men and women, mostly Kurds, were put in detention camps prior to Iraq's invasion of Iran. The fate of the Kurdish prisoners is still a mystery. As one Iraqi refugee tells it, 5,000 Kurdish youth vanished into thin air. An Iraqi Kurdish dissident now living in Lebanon says Western intelligence knows that the detainees were used for chemical experiments. He asserts the detainees were taken to secret laboratories in Iraq and exposed to lethal doses of chemical and biological agents. Yet, Fisk wonders why George W. Bush and Tony Blair are silent about these atrocities. In the early 80s, at the urging of George Bush Sr., the U.S. sold raw materials to Iraq that could be converted to chemical weapons. As Fisk sums up, it might reflect the West's embarrassment of its support for Saddam Hussein during the Iran-Iraq War. Or could it be an attempt to avoid an inquiry into how Iraq obtained the means to wage chemical warfare against its opponents? The names of U.S. and European companies which sold Baghdad materials and technology to build chemical, biological, and nuclear weapons were recently leaked from Iraq's 12,000-page weapons inventory. 2 years ago, the people of Tonga, a small constitutional monarchy in the South Pacific, got a rude awakening. A report in the Australian Herald Sun disclosed that Autogen, a biotech company run by Australian industrialist Joseph Gutnick, had signed an agreement to conduct genetic research on the people of Tonga. The news report created an uproar in Tonga and among activists in Melbourne, London, and Geneva. The Tonga Human Rights and Democracy Movement sought to confirm the report, but the island's prime minister denied any knowledge of an agreement. But according to the New Internationalist magazine, Autogen announced it had signed an agreement for a health research project to identify the genes that cause chronic diseases like diabetes in the unique population resources of the Kingdom of Tonga. In return, the biotech company promised royalties to the island nation of 100,000 and free use of any medication developed from the study. In 2001, talk between the island's Ministry of Health and Autogen broke down, and in March, the biotech company threw in the towel saying it had no intention of doing any research in Tonga in the future at all. Yet local activists are prepared to fight new efforts at genetic exploitation. As Lopetti Senatali of the Tonga Human Rights and Democracy Movement stated, it is colonialism all over again. Today, the bastards are after our genes. The gusts of wind power are being felt in the oil patch. Texas utilities in the last year have invested $1 billion in wind power technology, according to a recent report by Public Citizen and the Sustainable Energy and Economic Development Coalition. Tom Smitty Smith, head of Public Citizen's Texas office, attributed the favorable climate for wind power to recent state tax credits for alternative energy. Smith observed, "We are seeing wind farms sprouting up across the Texas plains, and that means cleaner air and a shot in the arm to the state's economy as well. It is also a throwback to the early 1900s, when 8 million wind turbines were installed for pump water to grind grain and produce power for rural areas. It was not until the 1940s that wind power was replaced by cheaper fossil fuel-generated electricity." Advocates say the potential for wind power in Texas is huge, 10 times the current amount of electricity that is currently sold in the Lone Star State. In the last year alone, wind power operators have built 912 megawatts of new capacity, creating 2,500 new jobs and $75 million in payroll in the West Texas region. Wind power also has great potential in many Great Plains states, such as Montana, North Dakota, and Oklahoma. In the Northeast, a huge wind farm has been proposed off the shore of Cape Cod and Martha's Vineyard. During peak times, a wind farm there could generate 420 megawatts of power, enough to replace the equivalent of 113 million gallons of oil. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Sasha Summer Cousineau.
One year after announcing America's withdrawal from the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, signed with the former Soviet Union in 1972, President Bush made public his administration's plan to deploy the system's first missiles in Alaska by 2004. While Russia and China have muted their criticism of the U.S. move, their military leaders have warned that the Bush decision to deploy a missile defense system will likely mean their nations will build more intercontinental missiles with countermeasures to reduce any American advantage. Many political and military observers also express concern that Bush's decision to build an anti-missile system will provoke nuclear enemies, India and Pakistan, to further build up their atomic arsenals. Beyond the global instability this decision may produce, scientists maintain that the costly system being built will be ineffective at intercepting any attack by real or imagined enemies such as North Korea. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Stephen Young, senior analyst with the Union of Concerned Scientists Global Security Program, who takes a critical look at the viability of and likely fallout from deployment of a U.S. anti-missile system.
The Bush plans that were announced last week are actually to put missiles in two places. First, about 16 missiles in Alaska, and actually about four more at Vandenberg Air Force Base in California. And the point of both those locations is to defend, in theory, the United States against attack, small attack from North Korea, which in fact does not at this point even have a missile that could hit the U.S. with a nuclear warhead. And so it's a little bit theoretical. And the fact is that for the last 40 years, Russia, and for the last 20 years, China, have already had long-range missiles that could hit the U.S. And we've had a very effective defense against that called deterrence. The thing about a missile is, if someone launches a missile at you, you know precisely where it came from. And so if North Korea decides to attack us, it'll simply be obliterated.
Now, just in terms of the effectiveness, the potential effectiveness of this weapon system, there's been a bunch of tests the Pentagon have gone forward with, and it's been mixed results at best. There's been many failures and some minor successes. Why don't you summarize those for us?
The tests are all very heavily scripted. The fact that the launch comes at a known time for a known location on a known trajectory, and in fact the defense knows in advance the size and shape of the warhead and the size and shape of any decoys or countermeasures that go with the warhead. So rather than having to find these things in space, the kill vehicle, as it's called, the interceptor's key component that is what tries to smash into the incoming warhead, knows precisely what it's looking for in space. Of course, in the actual event of an attack, the kill vehicle wouldn't know what to look for. It could face a series of objects of various sizes and shapes that could fool it very easily. So the testing has shown so far that given a situation where the warhead knows what's coming and knows when it's coming and knows where it's coming from and knows what to look for, it can be successful if all the parts work. But this is still rocket science, so inevitably there are failures. And so far they've failed in three of the last eight tests. And so clearly, even the simple level, when they know all these facts, they have a hard time making it work. In the real world, it'll be much harder.
Stephen Young, maybe you can address for us the repercussions internationally in terms of feeding the proliferation of other nations' nuclear weapons programs.
Well, I mean, there are several concerns we have on this front. The one that has been identified by the U.S. intelligence community, CIA and others, is the fact that China, in response to our deploying missile defenses, is likely to increase the size of its nuclear arsenal, possibly quite dramatically. I mean, we know, for example, that China has now roughly only about 20 long-range missiles that have nuclear warheads, one warhead on each missile, capable of hitting the United States. This has been the case since the 1980s. We also know, however, that they do have a research program to try and build more accurate missiles that have longer range, that have multiple warheads, that could hit the United States much more quickly as well. And so the question is, well, how fast will we move ahead? ahead trying to deploy new missiles, how many will they deploy, and how far will they push it. According to the U.S. intelligence community, China is likely to increase their arsenal by about tenfold, from 20 up to 200 long-range missiles if we deploy missile defenses. And so, in actual fact, we're starting a new arms race, perchance, by doing this. So by trying to defend ourselves, we encourage others to increase their ability to attack us.
If China, as you say, increases the numbers of intercontinental missiles it deploys, that will have a cascade effect in Asia and South Asia, with India and Pakistan very possibly trying to compete with China.
Yeah, there's certainly a whole host of problems. The other one being that Russia, whose nuclear arsenal is certainly going down, which is something we all want to see happen. Unfortunately, the arsenal they have, which is still very large at this point, falling down from around 5,000 long-range warheads down to around 2,000 over the next 10 years. But of those 2,000 that are going to be left, the majority are still on high alert.
Tell us all the reasons why the Union of Concerned Scientists are opposed to deployment of this system. What are the alternatives to better defend the country against rogue missile attacks that the administration has been talking so much about lately?
I mean, the primary question really is one of priorities and implications. I mean, the fact is that we're spending about $8 billion a year now on missile defenses of various kinds, which is argued, I think, a very minimal threat. It's very unlikely that North Korea is going to attack us because they know they would be killed if they did. However, if North Korea did want to attack us, they could fairly easily put a nuclear weapon in a container ship and have it blow up in New York or Los Angeles. We don't spend anywhere near the kind of money we're spending on missile defense as we do on port security, trying to inspect the thousands of cargo ships that come into the U.S. every day. We also don't spend nearly enough money on trying to get hold of all the fissile material. Russia, since the end of the Cold War, still has literally hundreds of tons of fissile materials, the building blocks for nuclear weapons, stored in very precarious situations. From our point of view, this is the Bush decision last week, because clearly it's much more about a Bush re-election defense than it is about a missile defense. I mean, the timing is incredibly suspect. They plan to have this new system online by the fall of 2004, right before the next presidential election. However, the new system, I hesitate to even call it that, because it will essentially be blind. There are no radars that are going to be ready in time to guide the interceptors to the missiles that are, might be incoming. All they're going to have is very, very weak radars that can do the basic guidance. They won't have the kind of accurate capability that they would need to have. The Clinton administration, when it was pushing the missile defense program as it was, said its main goal was to build a new radar to allow the interceptors to have some guidance. That was dropped by the Bush administration, as far as I can tell, primarily so that they could make sure it's fielded in time for the 2004 election.
That was Stephen Young, senior analyst with the Union of Concerned Scientists Global Security Program. Contact the union by calling area code 617-547-5552 or visit their website at www.ucsusa.org. As if following their own script for justifying war, the Bush administration pronounced Iraq to be in material breach of United Nations resolutions, just days after Baghdad released an obligatory 12,000-page arms declaration. While some of the White House criticism of Iraqi weapons documentation was echoed by Hans Blix and Mohammed El-Baradei, chief UN weapons inspectors, most members of the Security Council affirmed that Washington's judgment had no standing without a vote of the full council. In a further sign of friction at the UN, many of the 10 non-permanent members of the Security Council were angered by the Bush administration's behind-the-scenes maneuver to delay distribution and censor large portions of the 12,000-page Iraqi arms declaration to non-nuclear states serving in that body. And with statements from the White House sounding ever more bellicose, calls for the U.S. to back up its allegations against Iraq with hard evidence are being heard more forcefully around the world. Public opinion polls here in the U.S. also reveal growing sentiment that President Bush has not made a convincing case that Iraq possesses weapons of mass destruction, justifying a U.S. attack against Iraq. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Joanne Landy, co-director of the Campaign for Peace and Democracy, who assesses the ability of the U.S. peace movement to slow down or stop the White House plan for war with Baghdad.
There's been a surprisingly vibrant peace movement in this country, unexpected, I think, by the Bush administration and by the pundits and by me, for that matter. I mean, I don't think any of us anticipated there would be such a wide and deep concern about this war as what has developed. Now, it may or may not be strong enough to stop the war. One of the things we have going for us is that there's really a worldwide opposition to the war. You know, in Europe, millions of people have marched against the war. In the Middle East, you're hard-pressed to find a country that's for it. It's not a popular war, and meanwhile, of course, there's the arrogance of power that the administration feels, and the failure of the Democrats to really oppose them in any meaningful way. That means that, you know, they may get away with it, but then again, they may not. I think there's a, you know, 10 or 20 or 30% chance that they can be stopped, and it's our moral and political obligation, I think, to do that. We are opposed to Saddam Hussein and to the fundamentalist terrorists, and we have an answer to that, which is a different foreign policy, that this war and other wars like it are the opposite of an answer. You know, there's been quite a lot of discussion in the peace movement recently about groups like ANSWER and Workers' World and Not in Our Name and the RCT. Frankly, I mean, I think that the bulk of the people who are going out on these peace demonstrations, either locally or nationally, who are having teach-ins, whose religious groups, whose trade unions, whatever, they are pretty universally against Saddam Hussein and against the war. And meanwhile, there's a kind of small group of people who have walked into an organizational vacuum who don't really represent the people who were involved in the peace movement. But it's a vacuum. And part of what we want to do is to give voice to a different viewpoint, which we think is actually the viewpoint of most people in the peace movement, which is not to soft pedal Saddam Hussein, not to soft pedal the terrorists, not to in any way minimize the evil things that they've done to their own people or their neighbors, but to say that the U.S. militarism and interventionism, is, far from being the answer, is an important part of the cause.
Your group has called for the removal of Saddam Hussein, but at the same time opposes the U.S. Plans for war against Iraq. How do you square that? Certainly people on the right continually ask folks in the peace movement to explain how they would remove Saddam Hussein if we're not going to use military might. Maybe you can address that.
I think that it really basically takes encouragement of the Iraqi people themselves to do this in a way that American policy has never really done. You know, once or twice they flirted with it in their own way, and then they walk away from it. And I don't think it's coincidental. The U.S. is really afraid of democratic upheaval. They see it as destabilizing. Their real plan for a successor to Saddam Hussein is themselves. You know, the reason they have no end game for Saddam Hussein and for withdrawing troops from the area is, as far as I can see, because they don't intend to withdraw. They intend to be there for quite some time to come. So if you want to get rid of not just Saddam Hussein, but authoritarian rule in the area and in the country, there's no way to do that except through an upheaval by the people themselves. Now, that doesn't mean that they should be left without support, solidarity, encouragement. But U.S. troops means that the destiny of the country is being controlled by the U.S.
It seems that within the next month or so, the Bush administration is going to make a decision whether or not it's going to go to war this winter.
Right.
There's certainly many things people could do locally and nationally. And what is your idea of what most effective mix the peace movements could take right now?
What you need is a multifaceted, vigorous, loud, and convincing peace movement that reaches out to the American people, that reaches out to the people in other countries who are upset about this war, and we have to do our best to make it politically so expensive for them that they won't do it. And it's not going to be easy. The odds are against us. Okay, I want to be honest about that. I don't think that we're likely to be able to prevent this war, but we have a chance to, and I think that means we have a moral and political obligation to try, and we have certain things going for us. The unease of the American people, the opposition of practically everybody in Europe, everyone in the Middle East. So I think it's a question of making a lot of noise, making it so that the Democratic Party politicians are not able to ignore this as they have been able to, that we pressure them to get up and be a real opposition. And we have to do that in the way that opposition movements have always done, you know, which is to combine the power of our arguments with the noisiness of our presence. And I think we have to really step that up in the next few weeks. These are crucial weeks.
That was Joanne Landy, co-director of the Campaign for Peace and Democracy. Contact the campaign by calling area code 212-666-4001 or sign onto their national statement opposing the war online at www.zmag.org/antiwarsigners.htm. Since reinstating the global gag rule against abortion on his first day in office, President George W. Bush has been consistent in his administration's attacks on women's reproductive rights, both at home and abroad. Critics characterize White House funding cuts, judicial appointments, and opposition to previously agreed-to international conventions as Bush's other war. The latest example could clearly be seen in U.S. policies at a meeting in Bangkok to work out details of the 10th-year action plan on population and development, the blueprint for the next 10 years for reproductive health in Asia and the Pacific. There, the U.S. delegation announced its refusal to reaffirm the groundbreaking 1994 Cairo Program of Action, which the U.S. under the Clinton administration was instrumental in writing and which promoted women's education, economic development, and reproductive rights. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Francoise Girard, Senior Program Officer for Policy at the International Women's Health Coalition, based in New York City. She discusses the Bush administration's assault on women's reproductive rights and what groups and individuals can do to challenge these policies.
The global gag rule is a policy that the Bush administration adopted on the first day Bush came into power, and it prevents international foreign non-governmental organizations from doing any advocacy on abortion, counseling clients on availability of legal abortion services and so on, if they accept U.S. family planning funding. So basically it gags those organizations, prevents them from speaking if they accept any U.S. money. That's even if they have received money from other sources which would allow them to do this abortion advocacy. Kem Kasten is a law that is on the books and that prevents U.S. funding for programs that support forced abortion and forced sterilization, and that's been on the books since the 1980s. But Kem Kasten was the pretext that was used to defund the United Nations Population Fund. You might remember that the State Department sent a team of investigators to China to see whether the United Nations Population Fund was in fact involved in coerced abortions in connection with the one-child policy in China. And in fact, the State Department's own team came back and said, no, there's no connection whatsoever. When this team came back, the Bush administration did not abide by its recommendations because the team said, you know, we recommend that you should fund UNFPA, given that their work is actually helpful in reducing coercion in China. On the contrary, the Bush administration turned around and through some convoluted interpretation of Kem Kasten said, well, UNFPA works indirectly with the Ministry of Health and the State Family Planning Commission in China, and through their indirect work and, you know, de facto, whatever money is given to UNFPA is, you know, indirectly helping the Chinese government. That's a very, very distorted interpretation of Kem Kasten as we see it.
Can you pick out one or two decisions of the Bush administration that you think have made the biggest negative impact on women's health, or is it all just one big mess?
All these actions are interrelated, and it's part of an overall plan to undermine women's health and rights. My main focus, my main line of work is the international side of things. So I've seen what the Bush administration has done at the international level, at the United Nations, during negotiations in the last year and a half on HIV/AIDS, on children, and now on the series of negotiations that will mark the 10th anniversary of the Cairo Program of Action on Population and Development. It's a seamless web, as far as I can see. The same kind of attacks on women's right to abortion, the same kind of attacks on women's access to family planning services and information, strong attacks on the rights of adolescents to sexuality education that's comprehensive and actually accurate, medically accurate. So what you see at the international level, you see at the domestic level. It's mirrored.
if the Bush administration is saying we don't like abortion, abortion is, you know, murder, and then they're limiting access to ways for women to avoid becoming pregnant in the first place, and then they become pregnant, doesn't that actually increase the abortion rate and maternal death rate?
Yes, and that's perhaps the most cynical and paradoxical aspect of the kind of policies that the Bush administration has been pursuing at the international level, which is that it claims to be concerned about abortion, but that's not what's going on. What's going on is a war on women's, what we call Bush's other war, and it is war on women's rights and women's health, because they are going after accurate sexuality education, which then helps young people make decisions about using contraception and condoms. They are not increasing the funding for family planning, and in fact, this year they cut the U.S. funding for the United Nations Population Fund, which is the principal U.N. agency that provides family planning services around the world, distributes contraceptives, provides sexuality education, and also provides maternal care, obstetric care. So it's quite paradoxical, and I would say it's awfully cynical to see an administration that claims to be all concerned mostly about abortion take so many steps that in fact curtail women's access to family planning and to information that could prevent these unwanted pregnancies.
What's your personal feeling about where things stand right now and what you have to confront?
We expect extremely difficult time ahead. The fact that now the Senate is in Republican hands will make things all the more difficult for us, I expect. So we're bracing ourselves for a very difficult battle, but there's no sense giving in. In fact, we have to activate the fight, and I personally think at this point that we have to put more pressure on the administration, and we have to go into the streets probably, you know, march and show them that we will not be taken for granted, that we are not going to let them get away with this. I think we need action.
That was Francoise Girard of the International Women's Health Coalition. Call the coalition at area code 212-979-8500 or visit their website at www.iwhc.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a recording of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756, or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikita. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Sasha Summer Cousineau, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. Technical assistance was provided by Kelly Ramirez of KPFA, Berkeley, California. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.